Welcome to Grow It Minnesota, the podcast about growing fruit, vegetables, flowers, and anything else in a cold, cold climate. I'm Mary Shear, a home gardener and author of the book, The Northern Gardener, From Apples to Zinnias. On this program, we talk to some of the best gardeners in the Midwest, so you can grow a more productive, beautiful garden, no matter the weather. Let's get on to today's guest. Okay, well, hello, everybody. And today, my guest is Michelle Brune. She is from the Twin Cities and is the brains behind the website and education platform called Forks in the Dirt. If you follow her on Instagram, you can see her great garden and her beautiful chickens and all of the fun things she does with vegetable gardening for the most part. We're going to talk about companion planting, but Michelle, let's start out by telling people a little bit about Forks in the Dirt. What do you do?
Hey, Mary. Well, thanks for having me. I think I started Forks in the Dirt really to have a way to share what I was finding out of what was going on with local food, with growing my own food, with farmers in the area. So I had left my job to stay home with my babies, and I really missed interviewing people and writing about what they were doing. And I realized that I knew a little bit more than most about some vegetable gardening and other gardening aspects. So I threw some of my own information in there. And so Forks in the Dirt got started.
Oh, that is great. So have you always been a gardener, or what's your garden journey story?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty typical. I mean, my parents did some gardening. My mom was a very avid perennial flower gardener. And I think my dad was more taking care of the woods around us. I grew up on some land. So basically grew up on a peat bog with lots of different wildlife, lots of different kinds of nature around me. So we had ponds, the kind of bog area, and then woods around. And I think being able to see how all that interacted kind of got me interested in that from a young age. And then from there, I gardened with my neighbor. It was the maintenance crew. I was out there weeding beautifully landscaped spaces and gardens. And then later on, during college, I worked at some nurseries and after college as well. And then I also lived in Sweden for a couple years and was on a farm there, and it was just gorgeous. And I think that opened my eyes to kind of local food in such a different way, from just food coming from so much closer to where it's eaten. The culture just was a lot more surrounded around local food in so many ways.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So tell me a bit about your current garden. How much do you have, an acre or 2 acres or less than an acre? What's your current garden like?
Yeah, so right now we're in a regular city lot, a little bit larger city lot. It's under half an acre in White Bear Lake. And I would say, I figured this out at one point, how many square foot I have in gardens, but I don't remember right now, of course. I have 7 raised beds, 4 by 8 foot raised beds. And then I think almost twice that amount in ground is what I remember from when I figured that out. So however many, however much space that turns out to be, it's a lot. It's really fun. Some of it's in berries, so that, a big berry patch takes up a lot of space. And I grow vegetable plants in between some of my perennials as well. So I do a little bit of the edible landscaping along with the official vegetable gardens.
Yeah. So, and how much of your family's food are you able to produce in the garden?
It kind of varies with what we end up growing. I love being able to give some extras away too. So sometimes I know that what I'm growing is going to end up at the food shelf here, but that's okay with us right now, because I also love supporting our local farmers who grow sweet corn much better than I do and some other things. So it's kind of a give and take, but over half of the vegetables for sure come from my yard.
Wow, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a little bit about companion planting, which I know you or actually you have a class about it upcoming in March, but you also practice that in your own garden. So how do you define companion planting? What does that term mean?
Yeah, well, I think probably technically it really just means growing different plants together for the benefit of each of them to enhance kind of their growth. But I think looking at it, you know, kind of preparing for this and thinking about it a little bit, what I've really figured out is that it's creating a welcoming environment for everything that you want to have in your garden. So from the soil microorganisms to the plants to the pollinators, kind of creating just a welcoming environment.
So it's not as, you know, it's not as cut and dried as, I mean, there's this book out called Carrots Love Tomatoes and things like that, which I don't even know that carrots do love tomatoes or they care about tomatoes one way or the other. But there is a lot of sort of myth making about companion planting. And so, you know, when you do companion planting, I mean, what do you think are the sort of the benefits you can get from creating that environment that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, there for sure are a lot of myths, and a lot of it is not based in science. So being the like person that I am, I love testing things out anyway in the garden. And I think gardens are just this great big science experiment in one way. So it's fun to have seen what has worked and what hasn't worked for me in the past. There is a new book out by Jessica Walliser called Plant Partners that I would highly recommend because she's really done a lot of the research on science-based specifics there. So if you really want to geek out with me on it, that Plant Partners by her is really good. And she also has a simpler book called Good Bug, Bad Bug that really talks about the insects in the garden if you want to get more into the science-based stuff, which I will really try and cover that in here as well. But as far as kind of the myths go, you know, some of it doesn't make as much sense as others just common sense wise. So use your good judgment on that. But as far as like what does work and what you will see as a benefit, it's really building some good soil, mm-hmm. weed management, bringing the good bugs in, and then keeping some of the bad bugs away from the plants that you want to harvest.
So let's unpack each of those a little bit, if that's okay with you. So like when you talk about building good soil, how are you doing that by what you choose to plant?
Yeah, I think companion planting often forgets about cover cropping. We don't really think about that, but I think cover cropping is just this essential way that we as home gardeners can really help build our soil. And by building the soil, I mean, bringing in the microorganisms that want to be there, giving the room to the roots into the soil that want to grow. There's so much that happens right at the root tips. It's called the rhizosphere, where mm-hmm. Within the soil, there is so much happening that we can encourage with a good cover crop, keeping the soil covered, even with a mulch, if you don't want to get into the actual cover cropping. But I highly recommend cover cropping.
So what do you plant for a cover crop and where do you put it?
Yeah. So really I've ended up putting an actual cover crop down over potatoes, especially because that ground is already disturbed so much after I've dug up the potatoes. Mm-hmm. I feel like I try and practice no-till as much as possible, but when I'm digging it up, then I like to throw down cover crop. And I use, if it's okay that I mention a company name,
yeah, absolutely.
Albert Lee Seed, has a really nice, it's called Nitro Max Mix, and it's oats, peas, and radishes, and it completely winter kills, so you don't have to worry about having things come back up in the spring, mm-hmm. and as the name implies, it's nitrogen rich, so it's really leaving a lot of nitrogen in the soil after you plant. So you plant it in the fall, you let it winter kill, and then you plant right into it in the spring. So it's very simple for most home gardeners to be able to use.
Right. So you would put that down like what in September after you've pulled your potatoes or something?
Yeah. And really it only needs maybe 6 weeks of growth.
Oh, wow.
To do something where it can establish, it can grow up enough to leave that green on the top that just compacts down enough to create a mat where it really suppresses the weeds the next year too. That was one thing that I think I finally planted it thick enough 2 years ago. So that last spring, when I was planting into them, when I was putting my transplants in, I didn't have to mulch. You know, usually I'd throw some straw or something down over the baby transplant so it doesn't get that splash up from the water. I didn't have to do that. And a couple months later, I was like, did I weed this and I forgot about it or what? And I it was amazing how well it really kept back the weeds.
Wow. And does it just sort of sit on the top of the ground then?
Yeah. And by, I would say August, I mean, it kind of had composted into the soil. So it wasn't really even there. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So cover cropping, that's a great way to build the soil. What about, are there other things you would do to build soil in terms of plant choices and things?
Yeah, I mean, anytime that you can use a legume, like a pea or a bean, that just brings nitrogen in to the soil. And then, you know, some people really like to plant bigger radishes and then leave those. I would say if you have like clay kind of soil, you can go ahead and do that. But for us, like a lot of Ramsey County is either going to have clay or sand. And we have sandy, sandy soil in White Bear Lake. So I really am worried about getting that organic material in there. So I've added lots of straw, and leaf mulch is something I do a lot of just to keep the soil covered and add that organic material into it. So compost, straw, leaf mulch, whatever you can be adding to feed that soil. Because what the goal kind of is to feed that soil so that the microorganisms that are near come up to that top layer so that they can help feed the roots of your vegetables better.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about like pest control. That's another one of the sort of benefits of doing companion planting.
With pest control, it's a twofer, I kind of think. Like you want to bring in the beneficial insects that will then take care of the bad insects for you. So you're really doing that with planting, you know, beautiful pollinator plants, which who doesn't want to do that anyway? Right. And a lot of the beneficial insects will need not only the nectar, but the pollen that are those good plants, those beautiful flowers provide. So they'll need the pollen in order to reproduce and lay the eggs for the next generation. And a lot of it will be the larva, the worm, the creepy crawly phase will eat the insects that you don't want more than the moth or butterfly, you know, phase.
Right. So it's things like, you're going after things like aphids and squash bugs and that sort of a pest insect.
Yeah. Yeah. So like calendula will bring the beneficials in that will eat the other guys. Right. It can get kind of complicated fast. But one thing, and I think some people get a little bit worried about companion planting when they think about, oh, I need this specific thing and that specific thing. And that's, I think, why I've come to realize that it's really about creating a welcoming environment. And nature wants to take care of itself. It's trying to get to this balance. And so if we just create some biodiversity, if we create things that are, you know, just like diverse, that different bugs want to come to, it will really help that out.
Right. And I found since I've put in quite a few, I have a very small garden, but I've put in a lot of native plants not too far from my vegetable boxes. You know, I got birds galore, lots of bugs, and the pest insects are way down. I mean, I really think it does, just as you say, creating that environment with a lot of native flowering plants.
Yeah. And, you know, I've got an older blog post on the perennials for pollinators. And I think any of those native perennials are going to bring in the insects that want to eat the other guys. And it's just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you get beautiful things like bee balm and milkweed and agasashi, you know, which that's the tea I'm drinking right now is agasashi tea.
Yes. And that is like the number one pollinator attractor plant in my garden. Anise hyssop or agastache.
Okay.
Pronounce it. It self-sows all over the place, but it's very easy to pull them up. And I let it, you know, I say, I'm going to let these exist where that, and they bring in so many bees. You just constantly have bees on them. Constantly.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and then there's also my mind just went blank. Meadow blazing star.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's another one that, you get it going and then it's there. So, and then there are a lot of annuals too, like the marigolds for masking some of the scent. So they used to think that, and this is something I just learned from the book by Jessica, that Plant Partners. So they used to think marigolds and such deterred the insects from coming near. And what they found out through however science-based research they've done is that it actually masks the plant smell that they're trying to find rather than deterring them. So it's not like they don't like it. It's just that they can't smell the plant that they were going after to begin with. So I thought that was a really interesting, you know, finding.
Yeah. So you kind of want to pick an old fashioned marigold with a lot of scent to it if your goal is deterrence then, right?
Yep. Yep. So it's for sure like those French marigolds and stuff I think are the top of my list. And they're, you plant them once and you will never have to, you can save seed so easily.
Just I actually have a little dish of marigold seed right next to me.
Oh, shoot. I can't send you any more?
No, thanks. I'm fine.
Funny. Yeah.
So let's talk about disease reduction. That's the same kind of thing, bringing in, creating the right environment with the soil and the bugs and such.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, you can't use companion planting to get rid of an existing disease necessarily that's there right now, but you can use companion planting to create a stronger, again, from the soil up, right? A stronger soil. The microorganisms that are there can really help. And something I guess I would also mention here is maybe the idea of allelopathy, or that certain plants exude things from their roots that keep other plants down,
right,
or from growing. So I think that being able to use that effectively can really up the game too for disease plants.
Right. So, well, I mean, I can think of an example of allelopathy that is, you know, quite prevalent, which is black walnut. And anybody who's had black walnut knows you can't, there's a lot you can't grow around black walnut. But what are some that people might want to plant, you know, to keep down?
Yeah. So, you know, there's living mulches too that have that allelopathic effect where it keeps other plants from coming up. So white clover, Dutch white clover, is something that you can plant. And I've overseeded in the lawn stretches between my vegetable beds. And you mow it a couple times a year. It's not, you know, don't have to mow it as often as grass. You do have to edge it. You know, it is a living plant, but it really keeps a lot of the other stuff down. And it's kind of slowly taking over the lawn back there. I mean, the lawn was horrible to begin with where we put the vegetable garden, but they're so living mulches like that. And also oats. Oats get really tall though. Mm-hmm. So you're going to need to plant something, you know, like a vining cucumber or tomato or something that can outgrow that. But oats are another thing that will just keep the weeds down with that. Cucumbers, actually, I've read this, but I have not tried it. I might actually try it in the back space. They actually will, there's a chemical that they exude that will keep weeds down. So if you don't put them up on a trellis, but you let them vine along on the ground, kind of like a squash would, like in the Three Sisters idea, where they really do tend to keep the weeds down, which is kind of interesting. I might have to try
shading.
It.
They're shading everything out. That would make some sense.
Right? Yeah. So I just mentioned the Three Sisters, and that's just a beautiful example of companion planting, kind of where it's synergy, right? So the Three Sisters is corn, beans, and squash. And the corn is a heavy feeder, so it feeds on the nitrogen that the beans produce. And the beans then have the corn to grow up. And the squash will then vine along the bottom, keeping the weeds down and shading it so that it doesn't need as much water. So I think that that's like just a really beautiful example of companion planting.
Right. That's a very ancient example.
Yes. So, you know, local and Native Americans have used that forever.
Yeah. And so have you ever done a Three Sisters in your own garden?
Yeah, I've done it a couple different times with a couple different plant combinations. Still working on exactly the right one. Last year, the squirrels ate half of most of my corn. It was very sad. But the beans still grew up the stalks, right? That was okay. Yeah. And the squash still grew along the bottom. I have grown most successfully, I would say, glass gem corn along with a Blue Lake pole bean, which is, you know, a vigorous climber. And so one of the tricks to that combination is the timing and making sure that you let the corn start early enough to so that the beans don't outgrow the corn.
Right.
Because they will take over. And then maybe set the squash plants in even a little bit later. So it's the timing of everything. But once you get it, it's right. I mean, I've done it in a community garden I used to run, and it was a 4x6 bed, and it was maybe 3 feet tall, and it was planted on top of blacktop, and it still worked. So, wow. I mean, if it can grow there, it can grow anywhere, right?
Yeah, and you actually got corn and beans and all that out of it. Wow.
Yeah, and that was with Glass Gem and Blue Lake, because I had figured out that that worked well. And then we did a white patty pan, a scallop patty pan squash.
Wow. Sounds good, actually.
They were so good.
Is the glass gem a fairly fast-growing corn? Because that's what I would think would be the problem with doing that in our climate, is getting that corn to get started.
Yeah. Early. No, corn, I can't remember exactly the temperatures, but it has a lower germination temperature than you'd think, actually. And I think one of the trickiest parts is to not have the cutworms come through on the corn once you planted it. So I do go out there, and I mean, I know this isn't something that a larger scale can do, but us home gardeners, we can do this, where we go out and we cut the toilet paper rolls and we stick it around the corn stalk, so that, you know, as those baby plants are sprouting, you want to make sure that they get past that stage where the cutworms can take them out, because there's just nothing more devastating than seeing babies taken in the prime.
Yes. Cutworms are really cruel. They're just cruel. So what are some other combinations that you use?
Because I've had some time to play with this, I've added layer after layer. But one of the things that has worked well for me for the last couple years now is growing tomatoes. And I grow them up on a cattle panel. So, just on a nice solid trellis. So they've got room to have some beans interplanted between the tomato plants, so that the beans are feeding the nitrogen to the tomatoes at the same time. And then right kind of in between all of that going along, I've also, I kind of alternate with celery and basil in between the tomato plants as well. And then in front of that, I do plant carrots, not necessarily because tomatoes love carrots, as you mentioned, although I have read that book and it was very interesting, but I've learned a lot more since then. And then another beautiful plant that sometimes is overlooked is sweet alyssum. Oh. And that is a wonderful to combat the carrot root fly, whatever those little guys are that get the carrot roots. So that's a really fun combination that I found. So, I mean, that's like a many layered thing. But also when you're like thinning out your carrots, to be able to smell sweet alyssum as you're doing that, it's not a bad thing, right?
No.
So some of those low growing, really matting flowers are really fun to have in there as well. And, you know, you're creating this a beautiful space then too. It smells good. It's inviting to the insects. It's beautiful to look at. It's more interesting than, you know, all carrots or all tomatoes or all celery.
And I could see that the carrot foliage, the top of the carrot, that kind of ferny foliage coming up around the alyssum, that would be a very pretty little arrangement in addition to being, you know, you could get carrots out of it.
It was pretty fun. That was a fun one to discover. And that's the thing, is that you just kind of play with it, have fun in your garden. That's what we're here for, right? Is to have fun and to bring those insects in a little bit. And then at the end of the day, if you get to harvest good vegetables, then that's the win-win.
It is a win-win. Yeah. So and I think I really like your idea of just creating the right environment by putting a lot of different things in your vegetable garden. It doesn't have to be all rows like, you know, like your grandma may have done.
Yeah.
it can be a mix up. So any other combinations you'd like to suggest people try?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the kind of well-known things with companion planting is bringing in radishes to lure away the flea beetles from other coal crops. So anything like cabbages, and even people will plant pak choi in order, because the flea beetles love those baby leaves, and they will just devour them. And flea beetles, you'll know you have them when you look like you have tiny little specks shot through your leaves everywhere. And it's kind of devastating. And then they're, you know, then they lay their eggs, and then there's ickiness in your soil, and then they eat the roots of your everything. And so flea beetles are not fun. And people have purchased, and I actually did this once too, years ago, purchased nematodes from a store. I actually got mine from Eggplant Urban Farm Supply, and it worked. I had a huge infestation of flea beetles. And so I did go ahead and purchase those, and it really helped. It's something where you sprinkle on and you water in to really help combat that with, you know, insect warfare, I guess you call it.
Yeah. So the nematodes, they're kind of like a little worm, or I've never used them. So explain what they're
like. Yeah. They don't look like anything when you're putting them in the soil, but yes, they are. I don't know if they're technically a microorganism or technically a tiny little itty bitty worm. But yeah, they definitely eat the flea beetle larva.
Okay.
Which is why I wanted them.
Yeah.
Some of it sounds so gross, but it's nature. It's doing its thing.
Yeah. And one of the other things I thought was interesting in the Walliser book, Plant Partners, was this idea of using some of these root crops as a way to loosen up your soil. I live in the part of Ramsey County that has clay.
Like, ooh.
Clay. And so starting out in my garden, I did use things that had long tap roots, both perennials and not so much vegetables, but perennials with tap roots, because I knew that would kind of like break things up a little.
And did it work for you? Did it work well?
The garden is growing better. The garden is growing well. So, and things aren't dying. I think that is them.
You know, I've never had to do that, because that's not what my soil needed. So I haven't played with that.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think that also is, people need to be aware of what kind of soil they're dealing with, what their particular light and sun, you know, their sun environment, all of those basics before you start trying to manipulate your garden to grow what you want to grow.
Absolutely. Respect what's already there and start working from where, you know, what nature gave you to begin with. And, and you know, raised beds, you can kind of, you know, go around some of that soil deficiency rather easily, but then also make sure that you're, you know, getting some good soil to put on top of that, and lots of just organic material in there is what's probably most important to feed the soil.
Right. Yeah. I think I'm going to plant some cover crops next fall. That sounds like a great idea and a great way to weed suppress as well.
Yeah. It was very fun to see how much that changed things.
So can you talk a little bit about one more thing? And that is like herbs. A lot of people talk about herbs as being good companions for other things, but why is that?
Yeah. Well, a lot of herbs, I mean, they do definitely secrete the oils. That's why we enjoy them, right? They have a lot of flavor, a lot of aroma, and that can actually be used to kind of confuse some insects, again, with that masking. And the stronger the smells, like the marigolds, like we were talking about before too, the stronger the smells, the more effect it can have. But there's very specific chemicals released from different flowers and herbs, from the leaves versus the nectar and pollen piece, that can affect things. And Mary, I don't know enough about those specific things. All I know, I do know that, let's see, as far as herbs go with companion planting, sage really helps melons and the cucurbit family grow. So whatever eats on the cucurbits, from cucumbers, melons, sage definitely masks or repels, however you want to look at it, the things that like that. Because I grew two big beds of melons a couple years ago at a community garden on that black top like I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And one, I had four plants of sage planted in amongst them just because I had them. And, you know, I had some donated plants, so I was putting them in. One had all the sage in it, and the leaves were perfect. The melons were perfect. Another bed with melons across the garden didn't have any sage in it, and they were pelted. Like, the poor leaves couldn't even get going. So it was really interesting. That, and they had I know what it was. It was squash beetles that were getting them so bad. And it was like the one with sage had no squash beetles, and everything else in the garden that summer had squash beetles. So that's my personal experience. I don't think I've read about, maybe I have read about sage and that, but that's one thing. Basil is another one with tomatoes, obviously. So basil and tomatoes, it not only helps with the wilt, mm-hmm. whatever causes that, it's like it keeps the pests away, but it also helps bring up whatever in the soil is needed to combat that early wilt.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Michelle, our time is just about up, and it's been wonderful chatting with you.
It's just so fun to be able to share a little bit about this. There's so much more, though, so many more specific combinations and stuff. But yeah, there, as long as you just enjoy it and grow some different things in your garden together, interplant, put some flowers in there, and have fun when you're doing it.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mary.
Companion planting sure is a fascinating topic. Please check the show notes for links to all sorts of articles and information so you can dig deeper into the topic. Also, I'm having a book giveaway. I have a copy of Plant Partners by Jessica Walliser that we're going to give away to a listener. To enter the contest, just go to the Grow It Minnesota Facebook or Instagram page and leave a comment. On March 10th, we'll pick the winner. U.S. and Canada only. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another show.